It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Olympics in Paris are now at a close, and Team USA walked away from the Games with a total of 126 medals.
The U.S. delegation included 18 athletes from Wisconsin, and yes, some of them are coming home with medals, plus some athletes with Wisconsin ties competed for other countries.
We're taking a look at Team Wisconsin and the top performances from the state's Olympic athletes, plus find out who might be back in 2028.
J.R. Radcliffe is a sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. J.R., welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, good to be with you guys again.
When I last talked to you, J.R., I was asking, how much Olympics are you going to be able to watch? How much Olympics were you able to watch?
Well, we watched a lot. Certainly, it was fun to have the two-pronged approach where you could get up in the morning, catch up on what you missed, watch some live stuff, watch some of the big stuff at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or so, and then catch it all kind of curated differently in prime time. I thought that was a really cool touch. NBC really had it figured out, I thought, this year, and so the prime time stuff would be more with my family, and it was cool to catch up on stuff we missed and also to kind of relive the stuff that we already knew was coming. It was pretty sweet.
Let's check out some of our Wisconsin athletes, starting with team sports. Milwaukee Bucks Giannis Antetokounmpo, one of the biggest names from Wisconsin in, recent history. He played for Greece in men's basketball. Germany eliminated Greece, but how did Giannis do?
Yeah, that was a really good Olympics for him. And a sigh of relief, I think, for Bucks fans that he came through without seemingly any injury after missing the end of the season with a really bad calf injury and missing the playoffs. I'm sure there were Bucks fans that would have rather seen him not play at all after all that. But obviously, very cool moment. It was the first time Greece had been there since 2008 in the Olympics. Great for him to represent his country. He scored 28 points per game. They played four games. They were the last team to make it out of pool play, going 1-2. Got a win over a very nice Australia team. And then lost to Germany in the bracketed portion, the knockout portion. Again, that's probably as good as you could have expected for Greece. They were in a very difficult pool. They had to play some just truly excellent teams, and making it to the knockout round is no small thing. So that was great for Greece, great for Giannis, and now he can come home.
And 2028, I assume if Giannis tries out for the Greece team, he'll probably make the squad, right?
Oh, one would definitely assume. Four years, he'll finally be in his 30s. He's going to turn 30 in December. So he'll be what, 33 years old at that point for the next Olympic cycle. But no doubt in my mind, he'll still be one of the best players in the world. And Greece would love to have him back, I'm sure, as well as his brothers if they're healthy and able to play. Kostas, his younger brother, was going to be part of the team and got hurt. Not a superstar player like Giannis is, but someone who will probably still be in that player pool going forward.
Team USA men's basketball, Oshkosh's own Tyrese Haliburton, NBA star, on the squad, gets a gold medal. He was the 12th man, though. It doesn't sound like he did a whole ton this time around.
He had one of the best tweets of the Olympics after he came home with gold and showed off his gold medal and something to the effect of, when you don't do any of the work but get an A on the group project, a lot of people really enjoyed that. He's a young ascending player. There were guys who with experience, both Olympic and otherwise, who, yes, were ahead of him on the depth chart. He got a few, he got some time to shine as the team was preparing for Paris and everything like that. And he's still a key part of getting the teammates ready, if nothing else. So he still gets gold like everybody else. Very cool for the Oshkosh North product to come back with a medal in his first Olympics.
And that's a team where there's going to be some turnover with some of those senior players you mentioned. So we could see Tyrese in the Olympics again. Turning to women's soccer, UW-Madison's Rose Lavelle, a new gold medal in her possession now. And, some tight games there. A lot of one zeros and no guaranteed outcomes in those.
Some of the best, I thought, some of the most exciting, dramatic Team USA moments in these Olympics were from these soccer games. Like you said, 1-0 in the quarterfinal over Japan on a great goal by Trinity Rodman. 1-0 over Germany in the semifinal. 1-0 over Brazil in the gold medal match. Very fun. Rose Lavelle has a very decorated career. She's an Ohio native, but went to the University of Wisconsin. She's got a ton of success. you know, on her ledger at this point. And she is not, she played in the matches. She didn't play the whole matches. She wasn't on the field when they were able to clinch gold. So, you know, even at age 29, she's kind of on the veteran end of the spectrum at this point. But yes, she will bring home gold. She's had quite the team had quite the photo shoot. She's definitely got some good, she's wearing sunglasses, having a very good time. It's definitely a vibe. Rose Lavelle, enjoying her time there and coming back with another gold.
Talking to J.R. Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at Team Wisconsin's performance in the 2024 Summer Olympics, both for Team USA, some representing other countries as well. A lot of attention on track. The sprinter from Rice Lake, Kenny Bednarik, he took a silver back at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. A lot of expectations. Here's Kenny Bednarik speaking earlier on Wisconsin Life.
First thing I always say is 100. It's easier for me to run that because it's quicker. You have no time to really make any errors because, you know, it's quick. It's like, you know, 9 seconds. And then with the 200, something's just different about that. I mean, you have to have speed, but you also have to have a little stamina with that. Once they get on that last 100 meters, if your technique is not on point, you're going to start decelerating at a fast rate. And that's something I like about the 200 is just, you know, getting out on the turn and then who can hold on to the top speed for the longest is going to win the race.
All right. So there he's saying the 100 is easier, but hang on. He didn't medal in the 100, but he comes home with silver in the 200, JR.
And a really great occasion for him. He's now a 2-time silver medalist in that event. I really, really thought he was going to win gold. I really believed it. Even after he took 7th in the 100, even though Noah Lyles was the spotlighted athlete and expected to win, he did end up taking bronze. Noah Lyles did, but I really thought Kenny Bednarik was going to win that event. And, you know, he gave it his best shot. I mean, that was a really good time, 19.62 seconds to Bogo from Botswana. Botswana does not win many medals. This is a huge occasion for that country. So you have to love that part of it as well. And Kenny comes away with his second straight silver. Then I thought, well, maybe he'll still get that gold medal in the 4x100. He'll get a chance to compete with the, you know, with the men's relay. They have these historic, amazing problems with baton handoffs, and this was no different. Kenny was right in the middle of that. He just kind of got out a little too fast and ended up taking the baton outside of the exchange zone, so they got disqualified. They weren't going to medal anyway, I don't think. So that was disappointing because I really thought that this was a gold medal opportunity for him. But obviously, when you win silvers in back-to-back Olympics, that is a massive, massive accomplishment. And his story isn't done either. You know,
yeah.
he could easily, you know, he'll still be in his 20s the next time the Olympics roll around. You could easily see him back in some of these events again.
I was going to say, I was wondering, is it too early to start thinking about 2028? Not too early for Kenny Bednarik. He's already talking about gold in 2028. So we can keep an eye on him next time around. By the way, people could check out that full Wisconsin Life piece with Kenny Bednarik. Check it out at WPR.org. Also, while there, you can hear from Nick Rusher from West Bend on the men's 8 rowing team. I talked to him and his mom. That men's 8 JR came home with bronze.
They did, and that was pretty sweet. You know, Nick Rusher's got an interesting backstory. His parents both rowed at the Olympics. I believe they met as rowers. His sister has rowed in the Olympics, but he's the guy who came back with a medal. He came back with bronze, and that was, I don't think it was like out of the realm of possibility, but it wasn't a given that they would come away with a medal. I think rowing in general did just okay at these Olympics from Team USA. A lot of Wisconsin connections, both on the men's and women's side in the rowing competition. More for sure on the women's side. You know, Maddie Wanamaker and Lauren O'Connor are Wisconsin natives, Sophia Vitas. And so they unfortunately did not come back with anything, but Nick Rusher and the eights, they get the bronze. I often love the bronze medal ones because those athletes typically, I don't think, go into the finals expecting to medal. There are obviously cases where athletes fall and are maybe are competing for gold, but the people seem to be really appreciative when they get a bronze medal. I kind of love those maybe just as much as gold. And that was the case for the men's eights, like you said.
Gosh, JR, so much Wisconsin here. We're not going to get to everybody. Any performances that you were focusing on or took away from this one that I haven't brought up yet?
Yeah, I think we hit almost all of the athletes from Wisconsin who did medal. Aleph Kelter, mm-hmm. she's an Alaska native, but she went to the University of Wisconsin, was with the rugby team, the women's sevens rugby team. And they were early on in the Olympics. I don't know if there's so much that's happened since then. If people remember, they won the bronze medal on a walk-off, like basically what I would equate to a a kickoff return for touchdown in the final minute in football. It was this breakaway against a team that they were not supposed to defeat, and they wind up winning the bronze medal in kind of thrilling fashion. That is not a sport that USA traditionally has that level of success in. So that was really cool. Alef Kelter had a very, very good Olympics. She didn't have that last breakaway, but she scored quite a bit for Team USA.
JR, quite a story there. If I remember, Alef Kelter played hockey and soccer at UW-Madison, and now here she is on the rugby Olympic squad.
That's right. Yep. She was a multi-sport athlete at Wisconsin, then found something else after she graduated. So that was pretty cool. Otherwise, there was a couple close calls right in a row, a couple UW athletes who just took fourth, just missed. Mo Ahmed, who was racing for Canada in one of the distance races on track and field, and Phoebe Bacon in the backstroke and swimming, just barely missed bronze medals. Both of those athletes went to Wisconsin. So I think that's it. I think we hit on all of them. There were a lot of Wisconsin athletes there. There was a really healthy contingent, and a lot of obviously a lot of them were in competition for medals.
And JR, the whole shebang ended with the closing ceremony and then the preview of the LA Olympics in 4 years. Do you think you could pull that assignment to go and watch this one in person?
I don't know. Honestly, I have not given that any thought yet. I feel like somebody from our operation should be there. I don't know if I'd necessarily be the first choice, but we will see. It's going to be a super interesting Olympic cycle, and I don't want to skip over 2 years from now the Winter Olympics, mm-hmm. because we've got in Keewaskum Jordan Stoles, the speed skater, who was very young in the last Olympics and is regarded right now as one of the best in the world and will be somebody to looked upon to get a lot of medals. So Wisconsin always has a healthy contingent of Winter Olympians, speed skaters in particular, and I would expect that we're going to hear a lot about those guys in the next couple of years.
JR, thanks for joining us. Good to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Anytime, guys.
That's JR Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's with us to round up how Wisconsin's Olympians did in the 2024 games. Hang on, still the Paralympics to go and a huge UW Whitewater contingent in men's and women's wheelchair basketball. Stay tuned.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, as school districts explore all-electric buildings, we talk with the Oregon District about how one of its elementary schools is performing.
We've actually made more energy than we've used for the entire year already, and August is always a month for us that we make more energy.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin school districts are exploring all-electric school buildings. Data from the New Buildings Institute shows Dane County is home to the state's first net-zero school.
In 2020, Forest Edge Elementary in Fitchburg opened with more than 1,700 solar panels, dozens of geothermal wells.
Now, the Menasha Joint School District is building its first all-electric middle school in Winnebago County through a $100 million referendum.
As schools apply for federal tax credits under the Inflation Reduction Act, we explore costs, efficiency, and sustainability.
With Andy Weiland, business manager of the Oregon School District. Andy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you.
And Teresa Lehman is director of sustainable services with Myron Construction, that's based in Neenah. Teresa, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Andy, let's begin with you. As the school year is just weeks away for so many kids, Forest Edge Elementary students and teachers once again going back to a school as an all-electric building. Can you help us understand what all-electric means?
You bet. So essentially what's happening there is that natural gas, which is so prevalent in our communities for heating needs, is actually only at the street in the neighborhood. It does not come to the building. So everything in the building works off of electricity. And we produce more than the amount that we use in a year, which is what makes it a net zero building.
And because this building has been in place now for some years, do you find that it continues to hold up? I mean, there is wear and tear with students.
Yeah, absolutely. The building is continuing to perform really, really well. The mild winter that we had this last year actually helped us achieve what we kind of call net zero, which means we've produced more energy than we've used. We actually achieved that a month early this year, which is kind of a little bit of a surprise. But we've actually made more energy than we've used for the entire year already. And August is always a month for us that we make more energy. So we've already secured that for this would be, I think, our fourth year running.
And how much energy are you able to return to the grid?
So right now, we've already exceeded how much we plan to use for the next month. We start kind of on a school year basis when we look at this. So I don't know that it would mean a ton to your folks, but probably this year, close to 60 megawatts of power will be going back to the grid that won't be used in the building.
Teresa, turning to you, you're leading the Menasha Joint School District through its first all-electric middle school. How similar is this system to Forest Edge Elementary?
It's pretty similar. For Menasha, what they have done is they've chose to utilize a geothermal heating and cooling system. And they actually have their hot water system tied to the geothermal system, as well as their walk-in coolers and freezers. So it too, like Forest Edge, will be an all-electric school. The only gas that goes to that school is in the gas generator, which is just strictly for backup purposes only. And then they have a 1.3 megawatt photovoltaic system on the roof, which will go to offset all of the electricity that the school consumes, both for heating as well as lights and plug loads. So similar in the fact that it's going to be zero net energy, like Forest Edge.
Andy, in terms of Forest Edge, with, you know, over 1,700 solar panels and you have dozens of geothermal wells, what can you tell us about what that is capable of doing?
So like we've talked about it, you know, we don't have to burn any carbon intensive fuels at all. Everything is generated from the building, from the photovoltaic cells. The geothermal wells, just as your other guest mentioned, that's how we heat and cool the building as well, is super, super efficient. So our building actually runs at a half the amount of cost of our other buildings on a per square footage basis. And last year, just because of some anomalies in the energy market, it actually ran at basically a third of the cost on a per square basis for our building. So we save a lot of money that we can then basically put into the educational program for our students, rather than sending it to the utility, as well as, you know, doing what's right for the planet Earth and the future of our students.
That's really remarkable, because that can certainly take some relief out of your operating costs, as so many districts are really struggling to make their budgets work.
Absolutely. That is a struggle for all of us these days. And we appreciate being able to put that money back into things that, you know, the students appreciate, other than just being comfortable in school. But the building performs really, really well. So, you know, they're not giving up anything in that regard either. It's always at a really good temperature. Humidity is controlled. We got lots of fresh air coming in. So so far the building's performed really, really well for us.
Teresa, geothermal has had some issues in much colder climates, like here in the Midwest. Do you find that the technology is changing, or is that not as much of an issue any longer?
It's actually not an issue. Myron has built over 90 projects with geothermal heating and cooling systems, including our own corporate office located in Nina. And we frankly just don't have the issues, I think, that some maybe have had. I know horizontal geothermal systems used to have some issues, right? Those are the where the vertical pipe or the normally in a traditional geothermal system like Menasha as well as Forest Edge, we have vertical wells. And so those vertical wells go about 400 feet down into the earth. And by well, I mean, it's a hole that's drilled into the ground. And then you have almost like PEX piping that goes down into the well, and then it comes back up. So we're just really using the earth as a way to transfer the heat, which the earth from 6 feet and below in this area is about 55 degrees. So as that glycol water mixture is traveling through that PEX piping, going down the well and up the well and down the well, you have so many wells drilled that are based on the thermal conductivity of the soil as well as the square footage of the building. So then as that water glycol mixture is traveling through the PEX piping, you're able to garner the 55 degree temperature of the earth. So in the winter time, really instead of like 0 degrees or minus 10 degrees coming into the building from an air standpoint and having to heat and cool that air, you're really utilizing that 55 degrees from the earth's temperature.
And Teresa, thank you for walking us through that engineering aspect of geothermal. I'm wondering, though, with so many hydrothermal wells, does that create any structural issues?
There's a lot of permitting for this. So you work with the DNR quite frequently when you're trying to lay out your geothermal systems and just make sure that everything is environmentally sound.
Teresa Lehman is with us, Director of Sustainable Services with Myron Construction. Andy Weiland is Business Manager of the Oregon School District as we talk about the cost and efficiencies of electric schools in Wisconsin. Andy, both Oregon and Menasha now held referendums to fund their building projects. Is having that community support essential to building an electric school?
I would say absolutely. You know, in our case, our community kind of rallied around our Board of Education, who then took the leadership role to kind of tell us and actually created a policy which asked us from an operational perspective and an educational perspective to kind of take the lead on sustainable initiatives. And Forest Edge is kind of our, in the end, our capstone project, I guess, if you would. We did some projects before that and learned these technologies before we did the Forest Edge project. But basically, you were talking a little bit before about some concerns. And these two technologies have been around for quite a long time. What I understand they're doing in Menasha and what we did in Oregon is just marrying photovoltaic solar panels with a geothermal to stay so that you're not burning any fuels at all. So it's been a great pairing of those two strategies to make it all work.
Has the district got students involved here, or how might the curriculum intersect with the building design, you know, that's being demonstrated in the buildings that they're learning in?
Absolutely. We took a lot of care working with our architect, Bray Architects, and HGA. We kind of combined the two of those folks to come up with Forest Edge, to use instructional spaces as kind of learning tools for what's happening in the building. So showing how far geothermal wells are, how similar to Menasha, our wells are about 400 feet deep, and how does that relate to an elementary student? So in our instance, one of our graphics, we took the Capitol building, which our students are fairly familiar with being just south of Madison, and tipped it upside down and showed that our geothermal wells are actually taller, if you would, than the Capitol building by quite a bit. Since I think the Capitol building is like 280 some feet, we go 400 feet. So just showing the relationship of those types of things, but then also talking about the science of it and how photovoltaic systems work and how it's very similar to how nature uses plant growth and those types of things, leaves to harvest the energy from the sun. So we, throughout the building, have different graphics that try to explain that to our students. And then we also try to take situations where we get kids active And we have a bike which the students can pedal that shows how much energy, how many watts they're creating by pedaling the bike, so that they can kind of get an understanding of the amount of effort and energy that it takes to create a watt of energy, and then trying to also show them how many watts or kilowatts of energy we use in the building throughout the entire day.
Teresa, I bet you appreciate these types of demonstrations.
I certainly do. As a construction company, it seems a little odd, but Myron is actually quite active in helping with environmental curriculum. So in the state of Wisconsin, every school is required to make sure that students, each student, gets 10 hours of environmental education a year. So it's really, really refreshing for me to be able to see schools like Forest Edge, which I have toured, and it is amazing in terms of how they use their entire school as a teaching tool. And Menasha will certainly do the same thing. So the bike example that was just given is a great example. Kids have a really hard time wrapping their minds around concepts that they can't see or feel or touch. So the bike demonstration is actually one of a really cool set of tools that you can check out through the Focus Keep program, and that's housed at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, and it's called Pedal Power. So any school can actually check that out, and it comes with this big board, and there's maybe an incandescent light bulb and a compact fluorescent light bulb and an LED bulb and maybe a hairdryer and a radio, and kids get on the bike and they have to pedal the bike, and then you're able to like have this little switch, and you switch over from maybe using an LED bulb to a compact fluorescent bulb. Mm. And the kids can understand how much more energy it takes them to pedal the bike to make the compact bulb work versus the LED bulbs.
And all of these light bulbs really adding up in energy savings when you look at it more holistically. Teresa, we are hearing from Andy there about just the operating cost savings, you know, half of the cost of perhaps traditional buildings. In terms of the building costs, though, that are associated with this type of energy efficiency, can you give us any indications about whether it's more expensive or what building materials are associated to be more expensive or less expensive with electric schools?
There is a cost premium to, first of all, installing a geothermal bore field, right? Because mm-hmm. you don't have a big bore field like that when you have a gas system. But so there's that cost. Then there is a slight premium with installing a geothermal heating and cooling system. But the good news is right now, due to the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, school districts, while they don't pay taxes because they are a tax-exempt entity, they can actually receive what's called a direct pay elective from the federal government that once they place their schools into service, they get that rebate check in the form of like real cash check from the federal government, which helps offset that additional cost premium. And actually, it's less expensive right now utilizing the IRA funding to use a geothermal system than a traditional code compliant boiler and chiller system. And, you know, as mentioned, it is saving about 50% or more on your energy, on the annual energy utility bills. And so the Inflation Reduction Act right now, and I'll just use Menasha as the example, they have a 1.3 megawatt photovoltaic system, which offsets the 1.3 megawatts of energy that the school is going to consume in terms of heating, cooling, lighting, and plug loads. So combined, that's 2.6 megawatts of energy. And from the IRA, if your system is over 1 megawatt of energy, you're able to go from a 6% base tax credit, and then any systems tied into the geothermal systems, the other energy property that they would get a rebate on would be the photovoltaic system itself, and the microgrid. And then when you put a photovoltaic system on top of a school, you have to essentially beef the structure of the school up to be able to hold any wind loads or snow loads associated with the photovoltaic panels, which is an additional 5 pounds per square foot. So you're able to secure that rebate on that differential between a normal structure and a beefed up structure to hold that additional 5 pounds per square foot. With a school that's over 1 megawatt, if you use prevailing wages and an apprenticeship, your base tax credit goes from 6% to 30%. And then if you utilize the domestic content bonus, which is an additional 10%, if all of your iron and steel components are manufactured in the United States, and then 40% of the rest of that energy property is manufactured in the United States, you're now looking at getting a 40% rebate on that entire, on all of those energy properties I just mentioned.
And I want to jump in here and just field this last question to Andy. Has the Oregon district applied for these federal tax credits? What is the impact?
It's huge. We unfortunately built Forest Edge from a 2018 referendum, so that predated the Inflation Reduction Act. But we have taken advantage of an additional solar array that we put on our pool here in Oregon. And we actually just submitted last month to the federal government with our first tax return to get that 30% money back for our solar panels. So definitely huge incentives for schools, nonprofits, churches, municipalities to take advantage of this Inflation Reduction Act that's out there. It's not the things that you were talking about with Menasha are a little bit more complicated when you get into geothermal and those types of things. But for solar, it was actually fairly easy for us. So definitely encourage people to look into that.
Andy and Teresa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Andy Weiland is business manager of the Oregon School District, and Teresa Lehman there, director of sustainable services at Myron Construction in Neenah.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, author Joyce Carol Oates joins the show to talk about her time in Wisconsin, her latest novel, and why she writes in different styles and genres.
As a writer, I really feel I like to experiment.
Joyce Carol Oates coming up on WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Joyce Carol Oates is one of the most prolific and eclectic authors in the U.S. book world. She's published more than 100 books, including novels, short story collections, poetry, plays, essays, and children's literature.
Oates earned her master's degree from UW-Madison in 1961. And since then, she's had a long list of career milestones and honors, including the National Book Award and the National Humanities Medal. And she has been nominated several times for the Pulitzer Prize.
Her latest novel, Butcher, is a literary horror inspired by real-life medical experiments performed on women in the 19th century, with the main character based on three historical doctors. I talked to Joyce Carol Oates last week about her new book and how her time in Wisconsin influenced her life and career. Joyce, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Your new novel, Butcher, is about a 19th century doctor who performs really horrific experimental procedures on women at an asylum where he's the medical director eventually. Can you talk about why you tackled this subject matter in your newest novel and why now?
I have really long been interested in scientific misconduct and in the history of medicine, history of science. My late husband, Charlie Gross, was a neuroscientist with an interest also in a history of medicine. And the history of medical science is very fascinating. It throws a good deal of light on how people view one another today, especially in a patriarchal culture, how physicians and surgeons viewed women and how mental illness in women was treated often with hysterectomies and other surgeries that related to a person being a woman.
Your main character, Silas Weir, is based on some real doctors from the 1800s, including one with a very similar name. Can you talk about the research and the sorts of things you found, again, horrific things you found about some of these treatments and experiments?
Oh, yes. Well, it's quite fascinating. I think everyone really has an interest in the history of a developing field like medicine. Of course, the early surgeries were experimental. You can imagine during the Civil War when legs were being amputated and many things were being done that had actually never been done before. So, too, in my novel, in the 1830s, the doctors and research scientists were experimenting in many ways that seemed brutal and insane to us today, but at the time they were sort of blundering. Now, Dr. Weir, Silas Weir, my character, is a composite figure. There are really three doctors who are also sort of research scientists who go into the composite figure. And one of them is Dr. Weir Mitchell. He was very prominent, extremely famous in the 19th century for his theories about how women should be treated. And then J. Marion Sims is still known as the father of modern gynecology. And, of course, he's notorious for having operated especially on black enslaved women in great numbers and always without any anesthesia. But the one who interests me the most, because I live in Princeton, not far away from Trenton, is Dr. Henry Cotton. He was the director of the New Jersey State Lunatic Asylum in Trenton, and that isn't very far away from where I'm actually sitting. Mm. So by looking into the lives of these three men, I created a composite figure who seems to me very realistic. He behaves and thinks in ways that are very plausible. It was also very common that men like him considered themselves Christians, and they considered what they were doing in some way related to God's will be done.
You mentioned a patriarchal society, and it really shines through in the book, this research being done and these experimental surgeries being done by men, very condescending toward women, contemptuous of women, especially of lower social class, no interest in the consent of the people they're operating on. And what really strikes me, Joyce, is this is the foundation of modern gynecology. This is the foundation of the medical treatment of women. Do you feel like maybe not as bad as it was then, but that some of these attitudes lingered on long after?
Well, that's very true. As far back as Aristotle was considered that women were second-class citizens, that they were really a little bit subhuman compared to men, and that if a woman was upset about something, it could be like her role in life, she might not want to get married or have children, it was considered hysteria. Men could not be hysterical because hysteria derived from the uterus, the female reproductive organs were often removed.
We're talking to Joyce Carol Oates about her new novel. It's called Butcher, and about her time as a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Joyce, I want to turn to your time in Madison. I would love to say it was a wonderful experience and reminisce about those times, but you wrote in your memoir, in the academic department you're in the English department, this was in some ways a lost time for you. Can you talk about your experience at UW?
Well, I think I may have overstated. I came from Syracuse University, where the professors were extremely, I guess they're just younger, and they were more focused on new literature and American literature. When I came to Wisconsin, most of the faculty was older. They were from Harvard, and they were teaching in a way that is now not fashionable. They just lectured. Sometimes they just lectured from notes, and there wasn't much close reading of texts, which we did at Syracuse. Today, it's very rare in an English class that a professor just lectures. In my classes, we're all reading the literature and, you know, discussing and talking about it much more lively. So when I went to Wisconsin, I was sort of thrown back into an older mode of pedagogy. I remember one professor just sat and read from his own book. He had written a book on the American Puritans, and he just sat and read from his own book. You know, and we were taking notes. But the whole thing was very stultifying. It was very dull. I did have one wonderful professor, Helen White. She taught the English ballad. She taught medieval literature. And I think she was able to make it more come more alive. I have very good memories of Helen White.
There's a library not far from where I'm sitting named after her now. Joyce, as a young woman, these were, apart from Helen White, I gather mostly older men. And you talked, I think, in your memoir about, you know, getting married and them saying, well, a married woman academic. Was this just old-fashioned sexism part of what you encountered, a part of that negative experience?
Well, I think it was, absolutely. Yes. If I had it to do all over again, I probably would be able to navigate it a little better. I may have been just kind of naive. I mean, I had come from Syracuse where I was very respectful of me, and I think of other women students as well. But then when I came to Wisconsin, as I said, it was really more of an older patriarchy, and I probably just didn't know how to deal with that. It was just sort of not the right place for me. In a way, I can't believe, to quote Bob Dylan, sure is glad to get out of there alive.
Now, this is a weird sequence, Joyce. I read this passage from your memoir right before I read The Butcher. And you have a scene in your memoir where you're being effectively judged right by the committee that says, do you get to go on and do your dissertation or not? They end up saying no. And I don't know, this idea of a condescending group of older men set in their ways, deciding a woman's future, and then reading The Butcher, my brain is connecting dots there. Should it be?
Well, that is very interesting. I remember that so well, but it was in a way a blessing. I didn't have any intention of going on for a PhD. Now, if they had said to me, oh, Joyce, you are just what we want. You're going to be like Helen White. You have to get a PhD, and we'll give you a fellowship. That would have maybe ruined my life, because I would have toiled away in the library doing this historical research and talking about sources. And my life would have been really sabotaged. So as it turned out, there's a medieval concept of the fortunate fall, the wheel of fortune. But the fortunate fall is supposedly Adam and Eve. It was the fall of man. But then that brought Jesus into the world. So the Christian idea is that there was a fortunate fall. And in our lives, too. I mean, more than once in my life, there has been a fortunate failure at just the right time. So it cut off a road I might have been following that would not have been good.
Do you have other fond memories, Joyce, of your couple years in Wisconsin?
Oh, yes, I have many, many fond memories. I liked Wisconsin very much. I was very happy in Madison. I love the city, just the right size. I love the lake, the student union, that wonderful student union. My husband, Ray Smith, and I spent so many wonderful times there. We walked all around. We walked out through the agricultural college. We rent an apartment way out University Avenue, I think, or State Street. I can't remember the name, but it was way out. So we walked about a mile to class. I shouldn't just focus on the very end of my experience there, because the oral exam at the very end of the spring term was really a very small part of my life. I can remember very, very well walking around Madison University, that high hill, the long hill. I was really overall extremely happy there.
I know you get asked this a lot about your prolific nature as an author. You've written lots and lots of books. But interestingly, you know, I think some authors crank books out because they have a formula. It's always the same book with some variations. That is very much not what you're doing. Can you talk about not just the quantity of books you put out, but the range of subject matter and even styles and genres you've tackled?
Well, thank you for that question, because as a writer, I really feel I like to experiment. So writing about the butcher, the doctor, I could have written it in the third person, where we see him do this and we see him do that. I wanted to write about him from the point of view of the first person. Basically, he is telling his own story, and he incriminates himself all the time. He's so vain and blind, and he's comical.
Now, Joyce, I wanted to ask you, this is, again, your latest novel. You've written many. You are, I hope you don't mind me saying, well into your 80s. I hope to be in my 80s someday, and I hope to still have some kind of creative spark. Do you have advice, or what has kept you motivated to keep on creating?
Well, it's really just the opposite. I don't have enough time to do all the things that I want to do. I have many, many outlines for a couple of novels and stories, all sorts of notes. I have too many ideas, really.
And before we let you go, Joyce, I know you have a number of projects maybe in mind. Is there one that's at the front of the pack that might emerge as your next novel?
Well, my next novel is an experiment as a whodunit. I've never written in that genre where it's a mystery. There's a body, in this case a dismembered body, of a person. We learn about who he is, and we learn about the community. The man's name is Mr. Fox. He's a very popular middle school teacher, and first he goes missing, then his body is found, and then we sort of move through an investigation with a real detective, a real police investigation. So I had a lot of fun writing a police procedural. I love to read police procedurals, but I've never written one before.
I would read a Joyce Carol Oates police procedural.
Thank you. Well, it's all very realistic. This is not, I mean, Butcher goes into the surreal a little bit. Fox is all realistic. It's set in a realistic place. And the police investigation is very realistic. And there is a revelation at the end. You do find out who the murderer is. It's not an elliptical literary postmodernist novel that has no resolution. It's a genre novel with an actual ending. So I wanted to write about that in a literary way and sort of use unusual sentences and vocabulary. But I wanted to have that genre structure.
Joyce, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Very nice to talk to you.
That was Joyce Carol Oates, author of more than 100 books, the recipient of honors including the National Book Award and the National Humanities Medal. She got her master's from UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about her most recent novel, Butcher, her upcoming police procedural, and her time in Wisconsin. Be tough these days to find a good restaurant recommendation, whether you're looking for a straight-up diner or something fancy. Online reviews, they are not always super helpful.
Yeah, touch and go. Tomorrow, though, on the program, we'll meet a Wisconsin food fan who is trying to fill that gap with a Facebook group that's got almost 50,000 people participating.
And now we want to hear from you. Where do you go for a good restaurant recommendation in your own community or when you're traveling or visiting somewhere? Have you gotten a recommendation that steered you in the right or wrong direction? Do you have favorite places that you point people toward?
email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org to get in touch with us, or call or text at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.